Hello. First up, historian Bruce Gordon joins us to discuss the land of his birth, the Philippines, and their war against America, the nation Bruce would later serve as a fighter pilot during the Cold War. In the second half, Noreen and I look at the birth of the People's Republic of China and how Chiang Kai-shek handed his homeland to Mao Zedong. All that and more coming up on This Month in History.
We're talking about US Philippines.
Yeah, and the war they had 115 years ago. And we are going to be joined by, once again, by Bruce Gordon on the phone from Kentucky, USA. He's very knowledgeable on many topics of history, as regular listeners to this slot will know, as well as being a former US Air Force pilot for several decades who seems to have inadvertently prevented World War III from happening. And that's no joke. If you want to find out more, if you look back at previous episodes, you can find them on poorletters.com on the History Radio tab there, or you can go straight to iTunes and you'll find a backlog there. I've started putting them up under a This Month in History
I was going to say, I think it was April or May.
Yeah, March was...
Oh, okay,
was,
beg your pardon.
Yeah, Bruce's stopping World War III from happening. But
I still remember that episode.
It's
it was
quite
exciting.
Something. And he was also a schoolboy in post-war Hong Kong. And a few years before that, he lived in Hawaii, where he was eyewitness to the Pearl Harbor attack. But he was actually born in the Philippines, which is obviously relevant for our first topic today. And he's had articles published about the Philippine-American War, and he's read all 1,500 pages of the U.S. Senate Committee Hearings on Affairs in the Philippine Islands 1902, which is perhaps the best source of information from on the U.S. side of what happened. So, yeah, he certainly knows his stuff here.
Legitimate. All right, well, without further ado, let's welcome Bruce on the line. Bruce, good evening to you, I believe. It's evening for you. Good afternoon from us in Hong Kong.
Good evening. It's almost midnight here, yes.
Yeah, hi, Bruce. I was just introduced to you before you came on. And so today we're going to be talking about the Philippine-American War, 1899 to 1902, and some of the controversial and debated aspects of that war. And we know that you've got some insight to share with us. And the Americans were initially working with some Filipino troops against the Spanish, who, of course, had been running the Philippines for many years by the end of the 19th century. So I'm wondering, Bruce, if you can tell us a bit about how the Americans and Filipinos, who were initially fighting together against the Spanish, how the Americans and Filipinos ended up fighting against each other.
Yes, this is a case where the two nations were looking at things from entirely different viewpoints, and as a result, they get different historical viewpoints. America was looking at it from the Spanish-American War, and then they picked up the Philippines. They defeated the Spanish, and Admiral Dewey sailed from Hong Kong and entered into Manila Bay and attacked and destroyed the Spanish fleet. And America thus discovered that it had basically defeated the Spanish with their navy, and the remaining Spanish were left in the city of Manila. And the city of Manila was besieged by the Filipino guerrillas and the Filipino army, and Aguinaldo, their new leader, arrived and took command. The Americans gradually sent troops there. We had not expected to achieve control of the Philippines and did not have an invasion force on our ships. But over the next few months, the American troops arrived and took positions on a part of the Philippine line facing the Spanish. Now, the Spanish were cut off by sea and by land. They had no hope of rescue in Manila, and they were very much afraid of the Philippine guerrillas on the outside, who had many scores to settle with the Spanish. And the Spanish had been there for several hundred years now and had many of their dependents and many Filipinos were deeply involved with the Spanish culture. So the Spanish in Manila made a deal with the U.S. Army, where the U.S. Army would be allowed to enter Manila after a brief sham battle to maintain Spanish honor, and then the Americans would keep the Filipinos from entering Manila for fear that they would massacre the Spanish who were there. So that's exactly what happened. And on August 13, 1898, the Americans made an attack on Manila. The Spanish quickly surrendered, and the Americans then occupied Manila. And now we had the Filipinos under Aguinaldo on the outside, not able to get into their own capital. And they did not like this, to put it mildly. And this is how suddenly the Americans and Aguinaldo, who had been basically on the same side as allies, now the Americans were defending the Spanish. And things went on for a couple of months. And then on the February 4th, 1899, there was a battle with some sentries. No one really knows who fired the first shot. But the next day, the Americans decided that they were going to settle the case with the Filipino troops on the outside. And the Americans attacked. And the rest was a history of a series of defeats of the Spanish being driven, the Filipinos being driven back by the much superior American forces.
So this is...
That's what you want, you know.
Yeah, so this is obviously Spanish rule coming to an end in the Philippines. And for those who don't know, the Philippines is named after King Philip of Spain from the 16th century. So that's 300 or 400 years earlier. But we're wondering actually, can you also tell us why the U.S. wanted to invade the Philippines in the first place?
Well, I'm not sure that America really knew very much about the Philippines in those days. That was a long time ago, and most Americans had probably never heard of the Philippines. And we were mostly fighting the Spanish, and the Spanish fleet was there in the Philippines. Now, once we had defeated the Spanish fleet, we then made the Treaty of Paris with Spain, in which we thought we bought the Philippines from Spain. Now, that was not an unusual thing for America. America had bought the Louisiana Purchase, a huge chunk of America, from the French. We had bought Alaska from the Russians for $7.1 million. So we paid Spain $20 million for the Philippines. The thing we did not even consider was that the Filipinos thought that the Philippines were not Spain's to sell. And the only instructions from Washington to the people on the ground was you can negotiate almost anything with the Filipinos, but don't mention independence.
Bruce?
So we had a basic misunderstanding of what this was all about.
What was the relationship between Philippines and Spain at that time? Did they enjoy being sort of partly ruled by the Spanish?
No, the Spanish had been there for about 300 years, I believe, and they had established a Spanish culture. One of the things I read is that the Spanish taught the upper classes of the Filipinos how to speak Spanish, and the lower classes and the rest did not speak Spanish, so that language was a mark of class and a control of the populace. So the people were not pleased at all with the Spanish, and they started a number of revolutions. And Aguinaldo had been fighting the Spanish and was doing fairly well until just a few years before this. He was kind of bought out, I believe, by the Spanish, who paid him a goodly sum of money to leave the Philippines, and that's when he went to Hong Kong. And he did leave the Philippines when the Spanish paid him his money. So now the Philippines were left to the Spanish, but there were still plenty of guerrillas around there. And when the U.S. defeated the Spanish fleet and the Spanish in the Philippines were in desperate condition, the Filipino guerrillas organized and Aguinaldo arrived and declared independence. Now, the Aguinaldo apparently realized that the Philippines really could not be totally independent at that time because this, at the turn of the century, in around 1900, the Germans were badly looking for colonies. And there were German warships that had been seen in the area, and the Japanese were rising. So Aguinaldo later made the agreement with the United States that he would be a protectorate under the United States to keep out the Germans and the Japanese. And the problem was he wanted independence, which the Americans were not willing to grant and did not grant until some years later.
And, of course, one of the main reasons we're looking at this topic today is because we're within 1 week of the 115th anniversary of a particular incident that happened within the American-Philippine War. So I'm talking about September 28th, 1901, and I'm wondering if you can tell us about what happened then.
Yes, indeed. The city, the town of Balangia is a town on the island of Samar, one of the Philippine islands. It's not the main island, but it's a substantial island. And American troops moved into Balangiga in August 11th, 1901. We were winning control of the Philippines and sent a detachment of the Company C of the U.S. Army down there to occupy Balangiga, and they set up a small camp there, and they had those 74 soldiers there, and they then got along fairly well with the Filipinos until they wanted the Filipinos to do some real work cleaning the area in case of attack from the guerrillas who were in the area. They were known to be in the area, and the Americans forced the Filipinos to do some work clearing the land, and the Filipinos didn't like it. And every night the Americans took away their bolos and their bolo knives, the great big knives they carried, that they used to clear brush with. And every morning the Americans would give the bolos back to the Filipinos and they would go off and clear brush. Well, the Filipinos made a plan. And on December 28th, 1901, while the Americans were having breakfast, the town's Filipino police chief casually walked up to a guard and exchanged a few pleasant words. When the guard turned to resume his patrol, the police chief attacked him. A church bell rang, and the guerrillas and townspeople attacked from all directions, waving bolo knives. The garrison commander was killed in his pajamas. The American soldiers fought back, and the Filipinos withdrew. 44 Americans and about 22 to 50 Filipinos were killed. Only four Americans were not wounded. The soldiers retreated by outrigger canoes to another U.S. garrison, which counterattacked in a few days against the resistance. The Americans were so angered at finding the bodies of their comrades that they burned the town, but there is no evidence that there were any Filipino civilians killed during that burning of the town because the people had known they were coming and the people fled into the woods. Now, this was called by the Americans the Balangiga Massacre, and they were talking about the American troops who were killed while they were having breakfast. A massacre is defined as a number of people, unarmed or defenseless people, being killed by another group. So they're unarmed and defenseless. Well, the Americans were actually soldiers. They were not defenseless, and they fought back with the knives, as you can see, 20 to about 20 Filipinos were killed in this thing. Some Americans managed to get back to where their guns were, and that's why the Filipinos were driven off when the Americans got to their guns. And then the Americans retreated. But anyway, there was no massacre of the Americans. They were not defenseless. They were fighting. There was no massacre. And because there were no Filipino civilians waiting around for the Americans to come in to Balangiga to burn the place down, Filipinos weren't massacred. So there was really no massacre at Balangiga.
But there are different views, are there not? There are historians who believe the Americans, when they came back looking to burn the town down, did find Filipinos. I understand what you're saying there, that we don't have no concrete evidence of that, but there are certainly historians who would say that did happen. And I know that you're friends with the daughter of one of the American soldiers who was there, who took part in this as well. So there's definitely, as you said at the very beginning, different points of view.
Yes, but there is no real evidence, no one stating in the reports that there were any civilians killed. They do say that they buried the number of the Filipino attackers who had attacked. That's why we know, but they didn't say how many. People keep guessing between 22 and 50, so on. So that was of the attackers. There's no mention of Filipino civilians being killed. Now, the story then goes on to the number of Filipinos who died during the Filipino-American War, which was ongoing. And again, there is, let me say, no evidence of any large numbers of Filipinos being killed. I went looking for any evidence of a large number of people being killed. I did find that there was a large cholera epidemic and that killed lots of people, and malaria, an unusual number of people died of malaria during a malaria epidemic. And they think that it was because people were possibly congested and made themselves targets for the mosquitoes. But anyway, the number of Filipinos who died of malaria was high, but unknown, and wasn't really caused by the American troops.
Right.
But there were a lot of people who died of malaria. So between cholera, malaria, and an epidemic of rinderpest, which killed most of the Philippine caribou, which the Filipinos used to till their fields, the Filipinos then, with the dead caribou, they had to go out into the fields and do the work more or less by hand, exposing themselves more to the mosquitoes, and so malaria went on.
Right, yeah. So there's controversies there, and also there's an ongoing significance, isn't there, of the case. We look at Filipino-American relations in recent years, and we've seen, until the new President Duterte was elected in the Philippines, generally positive relations between the US and the Philippines. But underlying it, there is still an issue to do with that war from 115 years ago, to do with the church bells. Could you tell us about that finally, please?
Yes, indeed. When the Americans burned down the town of Balangiga, they apparently took several bells from the church. The exact number of the bells seems to be a little bit confused, but there are two bells that were taken as trophies, and right now they are in Francis E. Warren Air Base in Wyoming it is.
Right.
And there is one more bell, a smaller bell, that is at Camp Red Cloud in South Korea. Now, it's not really sure that these are all bells from Balangiga, but they are three bells from the Philippine Revolution. And they represent to the Filipino people the battle. The Battle of Balangiga was perhaps the biggest victory that the Filipinos had in their War of Independence, which they lost there. So the bells mean a lot to the Filipinos, and they don't mean that much to Americans. And it seems logical to those of us who work with it that America should give the bells back to the Filipinos. And I totally agree with that. But when they try to get things through Congress to say that the bells should be sent back, there are veterans in the U.S. Congress who prohibit it. So the bells never get the clearance to go back to the Philippines. And this continues. I believe they should be sent back with full honors and restored to wherever the Philippines want them, in a park or back to Balangiga, where they came from.
Well, we'll have to leave it at that now, Bruce, and we will follow this story with bells on. Hopefully the bells will get returned.
Thank you, Bruce.
Thank you so much for your time this evening, Bruce.
Thank you, Noreen.
Bye-bye.
Well, once again, many thanks to Bruce Gordon. We had him on earlier, just before the news break, talking a little bit more about U.S.-Philippines relations as well. So let's turn to our next topic right now. Paul, we're talking more locally. We're talking about China and the U.S.
Yeah, on this day, 21st of September, 1949, at the opening of the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference in Beijing, or Peking as it was commonly referred to then, there were cannons firing salutes, flags fluttering all around. Mao announced that the victorious communists would form a new government for China. So that's the 21st of September. So we're really focusing today on the birth of communist China, and particularly we're going to look at how the communists came to win the civil war that they've been fighting with the nationalists, the Kuomintang, in order to be in that position of announcing this new China. Of course, we all get a public holiday October 1st, although it's on a Saturday this year, so not for everyone.
Oh.
For the People's Republic of China being formally announced publicly. But really, from a logical point of view, if you look at the beginning of the battle in the Chinese Civil War, it should never have happened. The nationalists, the Kuomintang, should have won. So we're going to look at how Mao ended up as leader of China when at the start of the Civil War, 1946, the odds were so stacked against him.
And they also had the backing of the US as well.
Yeah, you mentioned America at the beginning there. And the GMD were backed by America and were expected to win.
And they were the superpower at that time as well, the US.
Yeah, but very much so. By the end of World War II, you've got an exhausted Britain, a defeated Germany and Japan, but you've still got America, well, going from strength to strength, so certainly number one superpower. And yeah, that relationship, as we'll see, is critical between Chiang Kai-shek and the Kuomintang and the United States. So we've mentioned before that Chiang Kai-shek's Kuomintang and Mao's communists had fought each other at times before and during World War II. There was at times during World War II a three-way battle going on, obviously with the Japanese being the third party there. But after the war was finished, of course, it's a full-on battle between communists and nationalists. Chiang was recognised not just by the US, but by most foreign governments as China's head of state, and then the Kuomintang as the ruling party. They held all the major cities. The communists held really just the countryside, some of the countryside areas, and not a single one of the bigger cities was in communist possession in 1946. The communists had no air force, very few railways under their control, no navy, and no foreign backing at all at this point. The Civil War, when it restarted in June 1946, when the GMD began a huge offensive in North China, the PLA, the People's Liberation Army, as it was newly renamed in 1946, it was the Red Army before that, led by Lin Biao, they fought back using guerrilla tactics, avoiding the big battles, because the communists knew if they had a full frontal battle with the GMD had the military hardware to win that, and also at the beginning, the bigger army. So with US training and equipment and money, the GMD were gaining ground in this early period of the Civil War at the communist expense. To find the crucial turning point when things change, historians have long pointed at when General Marshall, the American general, left China to go back to America in 1947, and President Truman pulled out US support, which made an overall GMD victory a less certain outcome. But then we'll say more about that. But historians Chung Chang and Ian Halliday blame US intervention for inadvertently helping the communists. So in 1946, General Marshall dictated, in effect, a ceasefire to the GMD, the Kuomintang, in Manchuria. And so, in other words, if you want American backing, you're going to do what we say here. Let's call a ceasefire against the communists in Manchuria, which was where the fighting was happening, the main fighting was happening at that time. But of course, this gave Mao a breather. He was able to consolidate his power in those countryside areas and use this time to then build a stronger relationship with the USSR and actually elicit military supplies from the Soviet Union. The USSR shared an 800-kilometer border along Manchuria. So a ceasefire there enabled the Russians to help the communists with little risk to their own personnel. And the Russians gave Mao 900 aircraft, 700 tanks, over 3,700 pieces of artillery, 12,000 machine guns, and so on. And at this point, the Soviets occupied North Korea still from the end of World War II. And from there, they supplied the Chinese communists with, we think, around 200,000 experienced Korean soldiers to fight with the communists against the nationalists in China. So the Russians were taking that time to rebuild the railway network for Mao in northern China, particularly in Manchuria, to link it with Russia so that more supplies could come through. And the Russians supervised the repairing of over 10,000 kilometers of track, which of course also allowed the Chinese communists to move their armies around at speed in the areas they controlled. So using nighttime raids and ambushes, the PLA gained much ground in central northern China in 1947, in part thanks to the ceasefire that was imposed on Manchuria by the Americans. And of course, peasants from the communist-controlled areas were encouraged, and some historians would say would emphasise that they were forced, and to be fair, I'm sure many were, but it's just hard to quantify how many, to join the communists. So either to join as soldiers or, in some cases, as labourers building fortifications and so on for the communists. Economic conditions in the nationalist-controlled areas were so bad they were losing the GMD support. 1 kilogram of rice, for example, by 1947 reached cost half a million dollars. There were strikes, there was riots, worsening conditions in cities made more and more city folk swap sides and throw their support behind the communists. So the GMD response to these problems was more censorship and more punishments, executions of opponents. And of course, that won them no friends at all. By late 1947, Mao and Lin Biao were gaining ground. They sent communist cadres into villages, more and more villages coming under PLA control. Often the cadres would go in before the communist army and explain the advantages of communist rule compared to the GMD. And so they were gaining more and more support. By 1948, some GMD generals had deserted or committed suicide. And with the hyperinflation that was going on, the price of commodities, rice and flour and so on, was spiraling out of control. That they had single banknotes, one note of 180 million yuan, monthly interest rates of 500%.
Whoa.
Before the end of 1948. So in September 1948, we see the first of three great campaigns, all of which started in the autumn, which is another reason why we're looking at this now, is obviously we're in the autumn. Three great campaigns, which would really bring the Civil War to an end, starting in the autumn 1948 and in at least one case going into the beginning of 1949. So there's one huge campaign in Manchuria where Chiang Kai-shek had picked as his supreme commander a general called Wei Li Huang, and many generals, certainly it's hard to quantify again, but many GMD generals were secretly working for the communists. And yeah, so Chang and Halliday, in their book, their biography of Mao, they emphasize how General Wei was one of those. He had actually asked to join the Communist Party in 1938. They told him to stay with the GMD as a communist sleeper. And so he's in control of the GMD army in sort of northeast China. Exactly.
Whoa.
So Chiang Kai-shek had his suspicions about Wei, but as he did in several other cases, but he was very more than reluctant to actually act. And so the army that Wei had control of was 550,000 troops in Manchuria.
That was his downfall. He should have acted on it.
Exactly.
If you have your suspicions about a man controlling you know, 55,000 of your army.
Absolutely. But do you know why he kept him? Kept him on? It's got something to do with the Americans again. That's where they come into it. At this point, the nationalists and Chiang Kai-shek were expecting, or hoping at least, to regain American support. And I'll explain why in a moment. So, and the Americans liked Wei, General Wei, because he'd fought well against the Japanese in World War II in Burma. So Wei was appointed in a futile attempt to gain American funding and equipment, or to regain it. And it wasn't completely without reason to think that might happen, because this time, autumn 1948, America was, as they are now, in the middle of an election campaign. And the Republican candidate, Thomas Dewey, promised to fully support Chiang. And Truman did not want to give Chiang Kai-shek money, but because of this pressure in the election campaign, Truman did supply the GMD with funds. And so that he could obviously say this, that we're taking the right side from the American point of view in the Civil War. Until, of course, Truman won the election, and then he immediately cut all aid again. In fact, Truman wrote to a friend saying, only an American army of 2 million men could have saved the Generalissimo, Chiang Kai-shek, and that would have been World War III. So that was the end of US support for the GMD. So with, as you can imagine, Mao's forces gained great success in Manchuria, trying to cut the long story short there. They fall into many traps, the nationalists, where they're ambushed by communist troops. And there was the communists were prepared to starve out cities. They did that at Changchun. Lin Biao said, let's turn it into a city of death. On the front line, we have placed one sentry every 50 metres, plus wire and ditches. They besieged the city. Those who got out, Lin Biao said, we persuaded to return. When starvation got worse and worse, hungry people flocked out. After we drove them back, they were pressured into no man's land. Many died of starvation there. And that city eventually had to surrender. Its population had dropped from 500,000 to 170,000. The death toll was higher than the highest estimate of the Japanese massacre at Nanjing. So, and those figures are from Chiang and Halliday. Another good source, by the way, for those interested in China's history, is the China podcast by Laszlo Montgomery. I'd recommend that. You'll find links on my webpage on paulletters.com. So Manchuria fell by November 1948. The second campaign would see Beijing and Tianjin fall into communist hands. It was in a similar way. The general in charge there of the nationalist side was General Fu. He was not a communist sleeper, but he was surrounded by communist spies, not least his own daughter, who was assigned by the party to keep tabs on him. So again, we see in this campaign that actually General Fu secretly wants to surrender his forces at an early stage around Beijing, but Mao wants to make himself look better, look like a military genius. So he forces General Fu on the nationalist side to delay. In the meantime, there's more skirmishes and fighting and ambushing, because of course the communists know all the nationalist movements because of their spies. And when Mao had felt he'd created a good enough image of himself as this military genius, at that point Mao did accept Fu's offer to surrender. And the third and final campaign, the Battle of Huahai, it's estimated that over 8 million people, by the way, were conscripted into hard labour building fortifications that I mentioned earlier. It's hard to be precise with the numbers, and that was particularly the case in this final campaign, that the large numbers of people were forced to join the communist side in particular to fight or work for them. And so this campaign happened between the Huai River and the Lunghai Railway line, so sort of between Shanghai and Beijing. And it took place really in the heartland of China, near Chiang's capital, Nanjing, as well. It involved well over 1 million soldiers and lasted from November 48 to January 49, overlapping with the other campaigns that I mentioned. But in this third of the big three campaigns, the outcome was not predetermined by GMD generals so much as by communist sleepers within Chiang's own headquarters. So not so much by generals in the field who are actually out directing the battle, but the
masterminds
behind. In the headquarters, yeah.
There were so many CCP sleepers then.
Yeah, exactly. How much emphasis you put on the different factors depends on which historians you want to go with. But certainly, undeniably, all historians would agree this was a significant factor, this corruption and betrayal within the GMD ranks, as well as the corruption and the misrule by the nationalists in the areas they controlled, and their failure to gain public support were other factors, and America pulling out their backing as well. So we're talking about officers in the headquarters who drew up the battle plans and could send them over to the communists, and again encouraged deliberately the wrong deployments of troops into areas where they would be attacked, ambushed by the communists, who would obviously know they were coming. Again, Chiang did nothing about the individuals concerned. He had his suspicions, but he did nothing until it was too late. And even then, he merely transferred the suspected traitors elsewhere. One of them, he actually moved to command the Nationalist Army in Sichuan. And this was on the recommendation of another communist secret agent in his headquarters. Yeah, why don't you move him to Sichuan? And of course, later, the GMD Army in Sichuan surrendered in its entirety. So by mid-January 1949, Mao had wrapped up all three major campaigns triumphantly. There were still smaller campaigns to go, but the big battles were done, and certainly Chiang Kai-shek would have known that his time was coming to an end, and he was obviously on the retreat and making his plans to escape to Taiwan. So there were more nationalist commanders who wanted to swap sides, and Mao would always say, right, say you have to wait until I tell you at the right moment before you allow to. The communists were concentrated north of the Yangtze River, but then would drive south towards the financial center of Shanghai, and also, of course, before that, and Nanjing, the nationalist capital. But by as early as the 10th of January 1949, Mao had told Stalin that his government can be created in summer or earlier. So through the spring, the communist army crossed the Yangtze, took Nanjing. That same spring, 1949, Mao entered Beijing, which of course had been the capital of China for centuries under the different emperors, most of the emperors. And Mao would make it his capital.
And of course, this month there has been a lot of talk of Mao in the first place, because he died 40 years ago.
Yes,
this month as well.
Of course, yeah, evaluating him, and it's such a difficult thing to do. It depends which bit of his history you look at for a start.
Yeah, maybe I'm a bit, probably shouldn't admit to it, being a journalist and all, a bit biased. I hear all these stories from my grandma about how horrifying and how... just, you know, the stories I hear, and they're not just stories because it happened to her, it happened to her family, it happened to people in her village, of just the bitter reality of what it was like being living in China during that era. Having said that, my granddad absolutely adored Mao. He came from a very poor family, and he wholeheartedly believed in communism and the equality for all men.
Sure, so he had nothing to begin with.
Exactly.
You're gonna gain something.
It was just so interesting just watching, yeah, my grandparents argue about this.
For me, it also depends. It really depends on the period. From the mid 1950s onwards, the Great Leap Forward, the Cultural Revolution.
Those are horrific,
indefensible, and.
But why is he still remembered as like this man who opened up China?
I think because of what happened, what he achieved before then. So before Mao was on the scene, China, of course, was so divided. There was the 1911 revolution, which got rid of the emperors, but did not bring in any stable, lasting government. You had warlords. You had really chaos and carnage across the whole country. And then Mao's achievements with the Long March, and then certainly his achievements, as they're portrayed, at least in World War II against the Japanese. Now, maybe more historians would give the nationalists more of the credit for fighting the Japanese there. But then, of course, he wins the Civil War. And it's hard to judge, but when you look at how the nationalists treated the people in their area, it's you can certainly see how Chinese people would see when the communists come along, it's relatively better than it was before. That's a generalization. But at that time, when Mao first gets into power, he improves education, he improves certain points of equality for women. For example, women could divorce men, which they never could before. It was only the other way around. So in those early years of his regime, there's and land reform as well. If you were impoverished, you had nothing to lose. You could only gain from that. Of course, if you're on the wrong side of that, you're denounced. And or worse, you're killed.
Land taken away.
I'm not saying it's good, but in that stage, there's certainly an argument you can make that he achieved some things that people, certain sectors of the society would benefit from.
That's the thing about history. There's the truth, but then truths are really opinions as well, depending on which side you look at the situation.
And of course, as soon as he gets into power, Mao controlled the propaganda machine, and obviously the communists have done ever since. So there's that side of things as well. And I mentioned at the beginning the October 1st holiday we've got coming up for the birthday of the People's Republic of China. And why October? Well, Mao chose to wait, although things were wrapped up by September 1949, he chose to wait until October for the official announcement of the new People's Republic, because October was the month of the Russian Revolution, the first communist revolution, of course, and also the 1911 revolution in China, which ousted the last emperor of China. So Mao's always got his eye on significance and what he can make out of timings of things, as you can tell. And so on Tiananmen Square on October 1st, of course, thousands turn up to hear him speak from standing on the top of the Gates of Heavenly Peace in front of the Forbidden City. Apparently, it's his first time speaking to such a large audience. And maybe 100,000 or more people who chanted, "Long live Chairman Mao." He was waving, and at one point he shouts back into the microphone, "Long live the people." And so again,
what a rock star.
Yeah, he was. And this was really maybe the beginning of him, his experience of portraying, of using that propaganda machine and the set piece kind of setting with a large crowd. But you know, he can really say that against the odds, he established himself as the ruler of 550 million people. So whether you were a communist or not, he achieved a lot from his point of view to get there. And so he publicly announced the birth of this sort of new nation as the way he was kind of selling it. Although the fighting was still going on in some areas. Chiang Kai-shek was still on the mainland at this point, albeit not for long before he went off to Taiwan.
They were a goner already.
Exactly, yeah. The fighting goes on in Tibet and Xinjiang into 1950, but that's, I think, for another time.
Yeah, definitely. Well, Paul, thank you so much for today. And for our listeners, don't forget, Paul also has a website as well, paulletters.com. Thank you so much for your time this afternoon.
Thank you. Hey, thanks for listening. You can get in touch on Facebook through the This Month in History page and through my webpage, paulletters.com, where you'll find my wartime novels and my World War II 75 Years On daily Twitter feed. Click subscribe on the podcast and get every episode automatically downloaded, all for free. And please write a review or give us a star rating. That makes iTunes bump us up their browsing pages. Thanks again for your support. We couldn't do this without it.